Okay, well, this is what I would like to talk about is also the role of the third mixing angle, θ13, and this is work done with my student Hasan Yüksel, and it appeared a few days ago on the web with some typos, and we fixed the typos. That's very quick. Well, I would like to remind you where we stand, first of all, with regard to the atmospheric neutrinos. So the Super-Kamiokande has finished its analysis. In a 2x2 analysis, they have seen, this is for mu to tau oscillations, and these are two sterile oscillations with two possible mass hierarchies. They rule out in a 2x2 mixing oscillations into sterile neutrinos, but they have seen consistency with oscillations into tau neutrinos with a very large mixing angle and with delta m square of the order of 10 to the minus 3 eV square. So in a way, delta 23 m square is more or less measured in this experiment. Well, as we know, the solar neutrinos measure θ12. Then the final question is, what about θ31? I guess people argue, there's not much argument there though, that θ13 is probably the most pressing open question in neutrino physics. There are a number of reasons about this. One is to check the unitarity of MNS matrix. Another one is the CP violating phase. Of course, you can put the CP violating phase anywhere, but if θ13 is zero, there is no CP violating phase. So whether and all the reactor neutrino experiments so far have been consistent with θ13 equal to zero. So it's important to understand whether a CP violating phase appears. This is very important to very long baseline experiments, which can be performed, which may become a reality if the National Underground Science Laboratory is built. And also, there are significant cosmological implications. The CP violation seen in the lepton sector perhaps is hidden in the neutrinos. So in that sense, it's important to understand the role of θ13. Most recently, Sudbury has announced a number of results. Most recently, last summer, they looked at neutral current and day-night spectra. By putting together their charge current, electron scattering, and the neutral scattering, neutral current scattering contributions, they have seen the LMA solution of the solar mixing angle to be the most acceptable solution, but still low was a possibility, the so-called low region was a possibility after the snow analysis. Most recently, Camland had announced its first results. And what I would like to do here is, one, to present a joint analysis of all the solar neutrino experiments and Camland, and two, while doing that, look at the role of θ13, whether we can put any limits on θ13 from those experiments. Now, let me just go over, this is straightforward, but it's always fun and instructive to go over this. Let me go over how we include θ13. There are a number of different ways to do it. Typically, people don't do a 3x3 numerical solution because that's incredibly time-consuming. So you try to find ways around that. Well, okay, this is my MNS matrix. I will put, in principle, the CP violating phase in θ13, but I will take it to be zero in this analysis. So again, C12, C13, and so on is abbreviation for cosine 13, and so on. One can write down the MSW evolution equations, and here they are in the most general form with the three energies, which you can write in terms of masses and in terms of the Wolfenstein potentials. Now, I don't know if, Lincoln, you are the first one who derived this, but no referee ever objects to me when I call them Wolfenstein potentials, so I will keep calling them Wolfenstein potentials. The contribution coming from the neutral current scattering actually cancels out because it simply brings a phase, so I will ignore that in the rest of this talk. Well, even though there are three mixing angles here in the most general analysis, I will show you, first of all, one of them disappears. That's because the neutrinos are not energetic enough to produce mus and taus. So astrophysically, there's really no difference between mus and taus in all the processes. So instead of individual mu or individual tau, you can take an arbitrary linear combination of them, two independent linear combinations. So in principle, this angle can be anything. So you can take out one of those linear combinations by fixing the angle to be the actual theta 2, 3.
You're talking about solar.
In the case of not just solar, but like in supernovas and so on, where you do not produce mus and taus. I'm talking about all astrophysical phenomena where you don't produce, where you don't have enough energy to produce mus or taus. So what I do, I introduce these notation, this rotation, define the tilde quantities, and then the equation I showed you take this form, basically theta 2, 3 disappears from the equation because that rotation matrix commutes with this guy. So then, you know, the problem really depends on the two mixing angles and the delta M squares appropriately put together. Now, the way I want to do this, I will introduce a second rotation on those tilde quantities, call them phi e, phi mu, phi tau. These are the tilde quantities. Introduce a second rotation. Basically, I'm going to redefine these three combinations, the evolution of which I will follow. Well, you can write down the evolution equation in terms of these quantities, where the Hamiltonian basically takes this form. The notation here is V tilde is the charge current, Wolfenstein potential times cosine square theta 1, 3, and delta ij, capital delta ij, is defined in this particular way. The initial conditions are that initially you start with all electron neutrinos, not mu or tau, so mu tilde and tau tilde are initially zero, which means initially phi e is cosine theta 1, 3, and phi tau is minus sine theta 1, 3, and phi mu is zero. These are the initial conditions that you need to solve. Now you immediately see that if this term was not there, if theta 1, 3 were zero, this is a block diagonal matrix which represents the evolution of phi e and phi mu, and this number here represents the evolution of phi tau, so they would be completely decoupled, and there is no effect of theta 1, 3 in the solar neutrino problem. Of course, theta 1, 3 is not zero. But there is a way of doing this, looking for an approximate solution of these equations appropriate for the solar neutrino physics. And let me just motivate that approximation. Now, from the atmospheric neutrino measurements, we know that delta M32 square is of the order of 10 to the minus 3 eV square. Now, I know that this is the approximate solar electron density. Bacall has given an approximate exponential expression. I mean, this is not the expression we use in the calculations. In our calculations, we use the actual standard Bacall tables. But just to make the argument, let me take this. Then you can write down the potential in the appropriate units. The potential in the appropriate units is 10 to the minus 5 eV square over MeV, as you expect, because there is a resonance and we get LMA to be about that angle. But the point is, then, this potential divided by delta 31. Remember, delta 31 has delta M squared divided by the energy. So this is the potential times energy divided by delta M31 square. So it depends on not only these two quantities, but also energy. But so this quantity is less than 1, even for the most energetic solar neutrinos, which are of the order of 15 MeV. Okay? So then this is a reasonably good expansion parameter that I can take to look for effect of theta 1, 3.
Even at the center of the sun?
Even at the center of the sun. Well, because at the center of the sun, r equal to 0, the ratio is about 10 to the minus 2. For 15 MeV, it's still less than 1. but of course it drops very quickly as you go farther away from the center of the sun. Now the trick I'm going to use is very straightforward, and it's actually a trick that was used in old optical potentials long time ago. It's very straightforward, really. Basically, let me write down the evolution equation that describes the evolution of phi tau, which is given by this quantity. I abbreviated the notation, so A is this and B is this combination. I'm going to assume that the mass hierarchy is there, so delta 3.1 and delta 3.2 are about the same, so I'm going to take them to be the same, and I'm going to call this combination to be epsilon for the sake of convenience. Now, this is a first-order differential equation in phi e, so we can immediately write in phi tau and phi e. You can immediately write down a solution for it, for phi tau, in terms of phi e. I mean, if you know how to calculate phi e, this is an exact solution. Now, the catch is, this is very good, but doesn't help me much. However, since I know v over delta 3.1 is a very small quantity, now this exponential here has a delta 3.1. So I can do an integration by parts. If I do an integration by parts, this brings in a factor of delta 3.1. And of course, the origin, and this t is where you measure it outside the sun. So I use the fact, if I do one integration by part, I bring v over delta 3.1 times cosine theta 1.3 times phi e. And I have to calculate that from the core to the surface. But at the surface, the potential vanishes, so that term vanishes. So I need the original term. Originally, phi e is cosine theta 1.3. So I can rewrite this integral basically as this term times this integral that I need to do again. Well, but of course, it doesn't matter. I can do one more integration by parts, and I will rewrite this integral as a series in powers of v over delta 3.1. If I do that, then this is the solution of phi tau. Here, the initial conditions are appropriately put together, namely, initially, this is theta 1.3, and here I use the fact that phi initially is cosine theta 1.3. Okay, so this is... You can see that this is an expansion, and the quantity that I called psi is actually a very, very small number. Now, this is all very good. The catch is, then, if I take this and put it into the equation there, this actually is an excellent approximation, but let me just show it to you here. If I take that phi tau and put into this differential equation, I immediately see that this term corresponds to sine squared theta 1.3, which is a very small quantity, so I can just ignore it. I can calculate, I take this to be zero, then what happens is that those terms reduce to a 2 by 2 evolution equation, except that the potential is replaced by potential times cosine squared theta 1.3. So all you need to do, take your standard MSW code, do everything exactly the same, solve it with the initial conditions that you typically use it with, which is 1 and 0, as opposed to cosine theta 1.3 and 0, and eventually multiply. I mean, this is a SU2 evolution, so I mean, this is then clearly an SU2 group element, so its evolution is an SU2, this is an SU2 algebra, this is an SU2 group element. Here, phi e and phi mu are solutions you obtained by your standard initial conditions, so you basically multiply it by cosine theta 1.3. So the bottom line is we eventually really don't need phi e and phi tau, but we need psi e to calculate survival probability, which is given in this term. If I put instead of phi e, the solution that I obtained from MSW equation with the appropriate initial condition, I bring another cosine theta 1.3. So this is the solution that I need to write down, and D is what I calculated. So the bottom line is then the next thing I do, I just calculate the survival probability, then it becomes this particular form, namely cosine 4 theta 1.3 times the standard 2x2 survival probability calculated with this modified electron density, plus sine to the power of theta 1/3 times these correction terms. So you don't have to do a new calculation. You just take your existing 2x2 code and just change things a little bit. Well, turns out, what we did is we also solved the 3x3 evolution equation exactly to see how good an approximation it is before we actually used it all the time. Well, it turns out for the mixing angles that one talks about in the case of sun, all these terms are very small. So it really doesn't matter what I have done. It really, well, in a way, this motivates it. It gives me confidence that all these terms are small. But what I will show you here, this is the survival probability as a function of delta M21 square for delta M31 square taken to be 10 to the minus 3 eV square and nuclear energy taken to be 1 MeV with these representative mixing angles. The red line is the exact 3x3 survival probability. The dotted terms are the first term of this expression right there. So it works quite nicely. This first term alone agrees quite well. This is the correction term. And this is the part of the correction term which depends on psi. So all these things are quite unimportant. All I need to do just basically take the very first term. Namely, calculate, in order to calculate the effect of theta 1/3, calculate the survival probability with the modified potential, and just scale it with the factor cosine 4 to the cosine 4 theta 1/3, cosine to the power 4 theta 1/3. So that's what I will use. But it's good to be able to show that it's a very good approximation, and the results that you get about theta 1/3 are reliable. Using that approximation. So what we have done then, we have done a global analysis. Basically, we have taken the sun, divided the core of the sun into shells, and calculated survival probabilities for each neutrino starting at that shell, and averaged over all the production region. And of course, if this neutrino is produced up in some part of the shell, it may follow a non-radial path. We had taken that into account. The non-radial paths are there. All the initial production region is integrated over. So what we have done then, we have calculated. Here I show you individual experiments. What we have done, we have taken the chlorine rate, total rate, and gallium total rate in our calculations. And the Super Kamiokande has divided their answers into 44 bins. So we have taken the 44 bin data. And we have used the snow charge current result. There is no neutral current rate here. Just charge current result as they give divided into 34 bins. Analyzing the snow data, we have used the snow prescription that is given in their homepage about how to do that. And the standard cross-section, all the cross-section, the cross-section, electron cross-section is well known here. We have taken into account all the radiator corrections and so on. In calculation of the snow cross-section, we used the effective field theory cross-section, but that includes a counter term. And we have taken that counter term, we have fixed that counter term using an earlier calculation of Wick for deuterium breakup. So that's basically how we have done the calculation.
What sort of error did you put on the RNA flux?
None. We have taken boron, thank you, boron 8 flux to be a free parameter.
So you have the multiplication factor.
Exactly. We have introduced a multiplication factor and minimized the chi-square with regard to the multiplication factor. And the same goes for HEP flux, even. We have done for both of them. So, but it turns out that it really doesn't affect things that much.
We don't get a crazy answer.
We don't get a crazy answer. So what I'm showing here is the analysis of individual experiments, not the combined. That chi-square is the confidence limits. The shaded area is the 95% confidence limit. and 99.5, 99.73% confidence limits are also shown. So you see that, you know, I mean, we have also taken into account the chlorine rate. We have also taken into account the day-night effect, and you see the day-night result there. We have solved the 2x2 MSW equation exactly. In the sun, in the case of sun, we use the Bacall profile. Of course, you can use any other profile. And in the case of Earth, we use the preliminary Earth model, which is basically two step functions. Now, immediately you see that already Super Kamiokande itself and snow itself, especially snow itself, rules out basically everything else except LMA and low solutions. This is snow itself, which in itself is quite an accomplishment, which obviously is a very, very good result. Now, once one does also in doing this calculation, we have ignored theta 13. We have set theta 13 equal to zero. We have ignored any magnetic moment effects. We have ignored any possibility of fluctuations. All the exotica we have ignored. Theta 13 is also zero in this calculation. This is the standard 2x2 analysis, just to show you how things look. I will show you in a second what happens when I set theta 13 equal to non-zero. Well, and then once you combined all, and again, sterile neutrinos are excluded. These are active to active 2x2 oscillations. Once you include all of them together and do a joint chi-square analysis, you see that only the LMA region survives at the 95% confidence level. And in order to low region to survive, already you need to go to 99.73% confidence level. I mean, this is in basic agreement with the snow's own analysis and other people's analysis.
In the previous slide, it looked like that sort of the one sigma area for both snow and super K had overlap, but it still survived with the low solution. So is it the Gallium experiment taken?
Exactly. The radiochemical experiments are still crucial. By the way, this is a single experiment, but this is the rate of three experiments averaged. So we don't see distinctions between different experiments. There aren't any anyway, but so it's radiochemical experiments are crucial. Now, the next thing we did is we looked at Camland. Now, Camland actually is a reactor neutrino experiment. It probes the same region, as you know. They announced their results in December. They announced a total rate plus a bin data. They have divided into three angle bins. So we have looked both of them separately. Now, what I'm showing here in this upper left-hand panel is the analysis of the Camland rate data only, nothing else. And again, 95% confidence level limit is being shown. Only Camland rate and nothing else. On the right-hand panel, what we have used the bin data, the 13 bins of Camland data alone, nothing else. And again, you see that these data already rule out the low region, independent of any solar neutrino experiment. I have not drawn this. We have not drawn this all the way down, but let me just tell you that they are ruled out. That's why we didn't draw. So this data alone rules out the low region. Now, what I show here is the solar LMA region only. So this is Camland rate only. This is Camland 13 bins only. And this is all solar only. Once you put them all together, this is what you get. And again, basically what happens is the LMA region is even further smaller. And 95, there's, if you are at the 95% confidence level limit, there's a single region and nothing else. I mean, this is a very, very small region. And the tangent square theta 12 is of the order of 0.45. Again, all these are still active to active 2x2 analysis. Okay? I haven't put the theta 13 yet. I mean, this analysis, similar analyses were done by other people, including people here, and they have obtained similar results. So this is there is consensus in the community about all these answers. Now, one thing I would like to show you, which I think is interesting, is what the individual solar experiments do. Just to see, what we have done is we have taken each individual experiment alone and analyzed that together with ChemMag, just to see what kind of effect we will get. Now here, this is up on the upper left-hand panel. What I'm showing you is the chlorine rate alone plus the ChemMag result. Again, the best fit, the minimum chi-square, is somewhere here. What I'm showing here is the gallium rate alone plus the ChemMag result. Again, minimum chi-square is here. What I'm showing here is the supercomiokande 44 bins plus ChemMag alone, a single solar neutrino experiment. And what I'm showing here, snow alone plus ChemLand. The interesting thing is if I take, I don't have that here for me right now, but if I ignore one of these experiments, I can already find the same answer by taking out one of the solar neutrino experiments. So in the past, people worried about whether one experiment is right and so on. So that ChemLand data completely eliminates that, and this graph actually shows you. One can even use one solar neutrino experiment to measure something else, if you wish. For example, we are doing a calculation right now. I don't have the result, but it's not that important. What we are doing is take the chlorine rate, gallium rate, and supercomiokande 44 bins together, extract delta M squared from there, and use that together with the snow result to measure neutrino deuterium cross-sections and calculate the counter term. See how it looks like. You can do things like that. And we are doing that just to get a different check. So that's where the quality of the data is. Now, what happens if you turn on the Theta 1-3? Of course, it's not that easy to make a three-dimensional plot. So unfortunately, all I can show you is fixing a value of Theta 1-2 and look at delta 2-1 square cosine to the power Theta 1-3 regime. And again, let me just show you one thing here. If you, it's already here, actually. If you look at, this is the correction that we're calculating. And I have shown you the corrections proportional to Xi are very, very small. The only place where delta M31 appears is in the corrections. So delta M31 is not really constrained by the solar neutrino experiments. It's a completely free parameter, if you wish. So the solar neutrino experiments, in principle, can at most depend on theta 1-2, theta 1-3, and delta M12 square. Okay? So that's why we fix one of them and look at the other two. So this is, again, what I'm showing here is a series of panels, pairs of panels, I would say. On the left panel, the solar data alone, what you get from the solar data alone. On the right-hand panel, solar plus ChemLand. So for example, that's actually quite an interesting exercise. For example, if you were to fix, if you take the solar data alone and take 10 square theta 1-2 to be 0.3, a little bit smaller than LMA solution, by changing theta 1-3, you get a nice fit to the data from solar data alone. But ChemLand rules that out. I mean, what I would like to pull your attention here is that theta 1-3 is really constrained by ChemLand plus the solar, not just solar alone. Yeah, solar data is essential. Because here, this is a reasonably good solution with a relatively low chi-square, not much smaller than the solution that we talked about. This is, so there are a number of pairs, and as you see, as soon as you include ChemLand, the 95% confidence level disappears for a mixing angle, even not too different than the best fit solution, 10 squared theta 1, 2.3. Now, as you increase the mixing angle, the best fit is 0.46, make it 0.4. Again, a little bit region appears once you include ChemLand. This is the best fit for the three-parameter fit again. So the theta 1, 2 doesn't change. And if you, as you increase theta 1, 2 a bit more, and go, for example, double theta 1, 2, again, 95% confidence limit disappears completely from both, but even at 0.7, which is not a big difference, really, ChemLand constrains the data significantly more. Well, unfortunately, the best fit is this, and our minimum chi-square is when theta 1, 3 equal to 0. I mean, but this is a true three-parameter fit. And we have changed, you know, we have looked at the region of the parameter space quite well. And unfortunately...
Before you go on, can I ask you a question about
sure.
your best fit plot? Because, so what you were showing us before was with theta 1, 3 equal to 0.
Right.
Which corresponds to cosine of 1. And if I look on I see two separate islands there, whereas previously I thought I just saw 1.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. The reason is that the number of parameters are different. This is a true three-parameter fit. So the confidence intervals are a bit bigger. You see, this is a true three-parameter fit. The previous one was a two-parameter fit.
Now, but the limit on theta 1, 3, I can't do from
this. Limit on theta... Well, you can put a limit on theta 1, 3 at the 95% confidence level. It's less than cosine square theta... Cosine to the power 4 theta 1, 3 is greater than 0.9, which is not as good as the limits that finished reactor experiments put. Okay, the finished reactor experiment, Xu and Palo Verde, quote better limits. I'm sure ChemLand will give a better limit too. This is the very, very beginning of ChemLand data. So our best fit.
Bob,
yeah.
This is a two parameter fit. You picked theta 1,
2. No. This is a true three parameter fit. I'm just showing you.
Oh, you're taking slices of it?
Yes, slices of it. Yeah, No. This is a big fit. I mean, I don't know how else to show if you can come up with a better way. I mean, but, I mean, no, this is true. I mean, Scott's question was right. You actually see it. The confidence limits are getting bigger. But nevertheless, the best fit is still theta 1, 3 equal to 0. That's what we get. So unfortunately, even though it looks like the solar neutrino would depend on three parameters, delta M1, 2, theta 1, 2, and theta 1, 3. Theta 1, 3 really plays no role after the ChemLand and solar data together. I mean, one fourth more or less expected that, but it's actually nice to be able to show.
You picked delta M, the 3, 2, delta M squared 3, 2 was fixed, so you buried that too.
Here? Delta M squared 3, 2 doesn't come in at all.
It must be in some sense.
No. Delta, no, it doesn't. That's the point. Well, we assumed the atmospheric mass hierarchy, namely delta M31 is comparable to delta M32.
Yeah, I understand. And but the value of that
doesn't come in.
If it were 10 to minus 5,
yes, but
so
I mean.
We assume it's greater than something.
We assume it's greater than something, exactly.
And
then it doesn't matter, exactly. I mean, but atmospheric, this is, that's understandable, but that's the assumption. In that limit, it doesn't come in.
You say this doesn't make as strong a bound on theta 1, 3 as reactor experiments do. What is the bound for this experiment?
It's a little bit better. It's in terms of cosine to the 4 theta 1, 3, it's like 0.93. So it's a little bit better. Yeah?
Setting the CP phase to 0, I mean, if you switch it on, does it have any effect?
No, I mean, CP phase always washes out. For the solar neutrinos, it has no effect. Now, in principle, whether it has an effect in ChemLand is an interesting question, ChemLand alone. And I don't think so. But that's an interesting question. Of course, CP violating phase is important in long baseline experiments. The baseline of ChemLand is so short that the I don't think they will be able to put a realistic limit on the phase.
Well, diagonal probability.
No, it never comes in. It's just too short.
Yeah.
I mean, it's again, it's...
Just in general?
No, no.
This guy will probably know.
Yeah, you have
survival. Yeah, but of course, what I mean is, if it's a very long baseline, neutrinos would go through the Earth, then it would come in. No. That's what I mean.
Not for survival.
What?
Not for survival problem.
No, but you can do measurements.
You need to do mu.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But you can't do, I mean, even if you wanted to do that at Chemland, you can't do it.
Right.
Baseline is too short. I don't mean it comes into survival probability, but you can test it. So I think that's the way it is. I mean, theta 1,3 is consistent with zero, and it's just a true three-parameter fit. I guess this is all I have to say.
Will this Cameron eventually do better than the reactor?
Yes. Better than reactor experiments, I'd rather not get into that. Of course, Chemland people argue that their limit will be as good as the Shu and the Palo Verde, perhaps a little bit better. But again, they're the competitive. I mean, you don't agree, I know. But again, this is an experimental question. Let them handle that. The point is, I don't think it will be significantly better. If anything, it will be competitive. And
you need a shorter baseline.
I know. I know the argument, and you know, but that's what the Chemland experimentalists argue, that they will be competitive. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
Is that from Chemland alone, or Chemland plus solar?
No, Chemland alone. We're talking about, right? We're talking about Chemland alone.
We should thank Bob, and we can ask some more questions.
Well, one thing I should add, what Chemland really would like to do after this is really not to get better data for the long baseline or short baseline, but to look at beryllium-7 line. That's what they really want to do. I don't think they will get much better data to fix that question. I think that's where they're going to put them. So I don't think this will be resolved with Chemland. They're going to put their efforts in measuring beryllium-7 line, if they can do it.
What constrains or will constrain theta-2-3? Notice that in the Chemland, they seem to constrain delta m squared quite a lot.
Right.
Theta-2-3 much less.
Right.
And theta-2-3 at the moment constraint is all comes from putting all the solar stuff together, particularly like
this constraint.
Putting the gallium together with the thing that's
Well, I mean, a long baseline experiment.
No, I'm talking about
1-2.
I'm talking about 1-2.
I'm talking about 1-2.
1-2. What will constrain 1-2? Oh, I see. You said 1-3. Okay.
I'm sorry.
What will constrain 1-2 better?
1-2, in principle, Chemland is sensitive to 1-2, but in practice, it's less clear.
Well, in practice, they...
I mean, solar gives you some theta 1-2, I don't know, sine squared, third or quarter.
Yeah.
Which comes... which depends on fitting together, as I understand, the boron and the gallium.
Well, I don't know the details of other global fits, but this is a rather global fit. Chi-square, the minimum chi-square per degree of freedom here is less than 1.
But will it help if they improve their shape measurements or push down to lower energies? One of the things that might come in that
Angle is really hard from Chemland alone. Angle is really hard from Chemland alone.
That's because sine squared 2 theta 1.
Exactly.
So Chemland's consistent with maximum mixing at this point?
Well, Chemland alone.
That's their best fit.
Chemland alone, of course, is the best fit, maximum mixing. But once you include the solar data together with Chemland, it comes down. But Chemland alone, also in our fit, the fit I had shown you, the best fit is maximum mixing.
So they're not likely to help very much in
on the angle.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, perhaps a better solar neutrino experiment. You see, the gallium region helps, and gallium is the PP neutrinos.
That's the classic argument.
That's the PP experiment. Exactly.
Neutrino flux, and that's what you have to have to get the mixing hand. You have to know what the calibrated neutrino flux is.
Exactly. So, in a better measurement of PP neutrinos would help. As a matter of fact, I mean, there are two arguments why one needs an underground laboratory in this problem already. One is a better measurement of PP, another one is a measurement of theta 1-3 with long baseline experiments.
The PEP line is really interesting. The experimentalists say that you can't, I mean, the PEP line is absolutely perfect. It's mono-energetic, and even though the flux is not so high, if you go deep enough, then you can get rid of the carbon-14 back,
right,
that kills you. But the difficulty apparently is that the simulator detectors have relatively poor energy resolution, so you lose your sensitivity because it kind of gets swallowed by all the CNO background in that region. But you know, if you had a really good high resolution detector very deep, then
you need something like 8,000 feet or so.
7 to 8,
that's the number that Steve Elliott, for example, gives.
1% background.
Yeah, and if you go further down, your detector background takes over, so it doesn't help that much. That sort of is the optimal for PEP.
I know Tom Bowles claims that even though we have a technology in principle to see PEP neutrinos now, that it's the resolution issue that makes it problematic.
Yeah. Well, anyway, any other comment?
What's the next experiment that will measure or put a better bound on theta 1-3 or perhaps even measure?
I would say, I will give a more generic answer. Long baseline experiments in general probably occurs, but long baseline experiments. An appropriately designed long baseline experiment, say from Brookhaven or Fermilab to West.
Can I ask a more general question, sort of a question of what the opinion is, maybe perhaps more than anything else? But a couple of years ago, you know, when this place was turning out the 10 most important problems in fundamental physics, and then the condensed matter people got annoyed, and we did the 10 most important problems in condensed matter physics. And then Lars got everybody that was interested together, and we tried to do the 10 most important problems in astrophysics. And so there was a lot of competitors up there, and so they had the solar neutrinos on the board, and hardly anybody in the audience that knew much about them, you know, including myself. And so I commented without thinking about it. I said, listen, the sun is telling us about neutrinos, but neutrinos are telling us nothing about the sun. And he said, oh, that's right, and he erased it out. I want to know, when we put all this together, and probably this is for later,
Is
it right now, or neutrinos telling us anything, whatever?
Well, but that's
about the sun. Where about the sun means we're constrained. The sun's a reasonable.
Well, that was the argument, in a way, I was trying to make from this graph. Individual experiments alone determine the parameter space reasonably well. So I think now we can say that we more or less know the parameter space, and perhaps use one of the experiments to learn about the sun. We are there, I think.
You didn't quite let me get to the end. By the sun, I'm on things that were refinements of the solar model, standard solar model, and not starting over again with another set of assumptions on how you do plasma physics or physical mechanics. Are there questions up for grabs in the sun that need neutrinos for their refinement?
In the sun?
I mean, the first point is, I think, that snow, I mean, the first experiment that showed us that, in fact, we were learning that our picture of the sun was probably right. I mean, that's the first thing.
Yeah, Snow did measure the solar neutrino flux, total solar neutrino flux.
In a way, I mean, there was no direct evidence that what we were talking about the sun was in some sense correct. And so, I mean, that was enormously important. Now, the question is, are there some more subtle questions about the sun? One thing that we make people mention is, could one learn something about the CNO cycle in the sun? Could you learn that that's going on at the level people thought, because that's supposed to be other stars? Measuring CNO is very tricky, but that's something people are talking about. I don't know what the conclusion is. Quick, you know what?
It's tricky.
Experimentally, the measurement itself is really interesting, because the CNO content of the sun, because this is a high net density star, is really important in its early evolution. CNO cycle is not in equilibrium when the sun first started burning. So there's a period where the sun was actually convective, driven by the CNO instability that lasts for something like 100 million years. So measuring how much total C plus N plus O now exists in the sun is important for that reason. Then you also want to connect it to the metallicity you see on the surface, because if you have to look at a weak point in the standard solar model, it's always that we look at the surface and we measure the heavy element abundance.
It doesn't fit.
Nothing's changed in the last 5 billion years, and that's the same heavy element abundance that existed at the core of the sun. So being able to get rid of the metallicity as a solar parameter would be very important.
Actually, the surface metallicity in the solar model is an input. I don't think it's an output. When they evolve the sun, they don't get the right surface abundance.
Well, they have they put in things like settling and so forth, but initially you've got the heavy elements plus the helium plus the hydrogen you've got to fix, and all you've got is one handle on the luminosity at the end of the burning, 5 billion years of burning. And so you can fix the hydrogen to helium ratio, but you've got to put in by hand what the initial heavy element abundance is.
When you and Andrew Cumming were judging up Helium 3 in the deep interior or whatever. I know it didn't solve the solar neutrino problem, but is there some remnant of that left up for grabs?
Well, the theorist has always bothered me. It's connected with the CNO instability, because we know that helium gradient is technically not stable in the sun. And it's kind of like a quantum mechanical tunneling problem. Does the sun ever figure out that it can burn more efficiently by moving the helium 3, and why that connects to the early convective cycle is that if that cycle runs long enough, and you really have a puzzle why the sun didn't figure out that this established helium 3 gradient, mixing that helium 3 into the center of the sun allows you to get more energy at lower temperature. But that was a very unpopular idea.
Well, there is still a discontinuity in the sun speed in the sun at where helium 3 abundance may peak. If you look at the solar speed profiles that they obtain, there is a discontinuity there. I don't know if they ever explained that, but it's there.
The helium seismology was such a success.
Yes.
In general.
Although, I mean, one has to be a little bit careful. This is my pet peeve with helium seismology, and I think they agree with it, but I mean, it's not. When they do a fit to the standards, they use a reference model. So they're actually looking for solutions, minimum solution around the reference model, and they find that it agrees with the reference model very well. But when they do a global fit, they find a local minimum. They cannot say that that's the global minimum. It's too hard to do. So there is still an uncertainty there.
It's
in
that.
It's a variational calculus. They apply the standard Rayleigh-Litz variational principle, taking the standard solar model as the trial model. And they vary it, and they find that it doesn't change too much. But that would not give you a global minimum. That will only give you a local minimum. They argue that since it fits everything else, well, it's a good thing, but still, there has to be a way around that, and they haven't done it yet. I mean, there is in this country, helioseismologists disagree with the helioseismologists in Europe about the goodness of the fit. especially British heliosismologists don't take it as serious as the American heliosismologists. But it's a great success, nevertheless. I mean, that they can do that. But there's a little trick there. It's the same problem in quantum mechanics. Knowing the eigenvalues does not necessarily fix the wave functions. Right? I mean, if you know the eigenvalues, there is an infinite number of unitary transformations that you can come up for the wave functions. So basically, what they know in the sun, they know the eigenvalues, the W's. It really doesn't fix the wave function. So you don't really satisfy all the conditions of inverse scattering theory anyway. So there's that question, and that doesn't seem to bother other people as much as it bothers me.
I guess.